Well, it's another podcast from DJMCloud.com. With me, Daniel J. McKeown, and with Jessica McKeown.
Hi, everybody.
Now, today's date is September 24th, 2012. And I want to ask the listeners a question.
Hey baby, what's that sound? I take a few steps and I'm on the ground. It's a long shot, but don't I think you love anymore? Come on, come on. Hey baby, give it a try. I can find a reason if you want to know why. I know reasons to give them lives with a song. Come on, come on. How does it sound if we spend the night
out? This is when you wish you had the webcam version.
Yeah, we haven't done Ustream in a while.
We're rocking out.
You know, one time your cousin tuned into Ustream, and then I had the sound. You know, there's all these weird controls on the stupid, you know, flash interface of the Ustream, web app, and I tell you what, I did accidentally mute it because I thought I had the computer muted and I didn't, and she gave us feedback and I didn't know what to do with it. You know, I was like, oh, you know, like we had an audience, you know, a known audience. I think like we've gotten a few random trolls, like 2, 3, 4, maybe a few people we know. But I think we've peaked at higher viewers with the parakeets at parakeetstv.com, which, you know, that programming is, you know, it's on and off, but it's, you know, it's good programming when it is, because parakeets are just very interesting.
Yes, they are. Now, what cousin was that?
I think it was your cousin Star.
Cousin Star. So, if we were to look at the Apple World clock, when she was living in California, it would be 9:38 p.m. there.
That's good prime time. We should think about that. Maybe we should send a bad signal out now and, you know, tweet, you know, and say, you know, tune in or on the Facebook.
Yeah, people are suffering through the Emmys right now.
Oh yeah. Oh,
it's
boring. And they're looking at online and say, like, we divert people over. Oh, that is a very good idea. Do they tape the Emmys and show them at, you know, the same time, nominal time, but at a different absolute time, you know, around different markets, or do they carry it live across the country? That's not really, I don't know.
I wish the Apple clock would tell us that.
They stole it from the Swiss Federal Rail Service.
Let's talk about that.
Well, the clock that appears in the iPad now in iOS 6 is, yeah, that clock. Apple took the design for the clock in the iPad from the Swiss Federal Rail Service. They owned that design. Now, I'm not a fan of people owning designs, and
especially one like this. I mean, if you look at it really, it's circles and lines moving.
All right,
time,
but,
and everything moves at the same time.
Well, I think that
that's beautiful.
Well, that's reasonable, right? And it seems intuitive. I actually like simple, kind of simplistic analog clocks, although I consider them now just ridiculously outdated.
I hate this. It reminds me of school.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I think that that is a design that's so iconic that we may not really think immediately about what work it took to design. It may seem obvious to us because it was in schools. It's a known design. Now, I think we had bad numbers and like uneven tick marks. The clocks we had in my school were a design nightmare. That would be an awesome clock compared to the ones I remember at like my grade school. And you know, I think the high school had a range of different stuff. But I actually kind of like that. But it's, you know what? I think that it's like sans serif typefaces and fonts. It's actually probably more of a unique product of post-war Switzerland and the modernist movement than we really give maybe thought to typically. Because it's such an iconic design in, you know, many modern Western countries.
It is. And, you know, it's quite hypnotic looking at the second hand.
Yeah, I think that the clocks that, you know, that you see, I mean, it's like, I mean, if Apple really has conviction behind their accusations about Samsung copying,
mm-hmm.
then what are they doing? Doing such, you know, making such an obvious copy of someone else. And they, there was this article that you can find a link in the show notes. The Swiss Federal Rail Service was saying, at least in this article I was reading, that they do not actually have a licensing arrangement with Apple. And so, you know, Apple. I like their products. I like a lot of their products, but I mean, I think this is some pretty. It seems kind of blatant, a little questionable when you're stealing a design from someone and you want to play in this sandbox. You want to live in the world where trivial design details can be sued over, and that really kind of. Makes me think of what the other kind of side of this I was thinking of is that it's like I think it's insulting, like the arguments that Apple makes in court, and I think that they really there should be some public awareness. I'm not saying there should be some public relations repercussions, and I don't think this is going to affect their, you know, their sales if people know this, but I think that it's very insulting to people, the trade dress claims that they're making. They're basically saying that the boxes and stuff and the way that stuff is packaged and so is enough to fool consumers. Like, and you know, people that buy a Samsung phone or an Apple iPhone, like, I think people have a good idea what they're doing. I think, like, we have to give people a little more credit. There are some people that, you know, people make different choices about what phone they want, but it's really hard to think that someone, because I remember when I was about to get my iPhone 4, I looked at a Samsung Galaxy S2 or something, I think, or something in that ballpark, and you know, it didn't look anything like an iPhone, and it wasn't to be confused with an iPhone. It wasn't anything like an iPhone.
Well, it's demonstrative to the industry, you know. Instead of putting the money and the energy and the efforts towards innovation, they're spending it on a design thing? I mean, if you've got a great product, make a great product. Don't worry about what other people look like.
Yeah,
I
that's
mean,
the thing.
That's the whole idea with design.
You build something, right?
And then they build something. I seriously think that Apple's like, I kind of like the back button. You know, let's talk about the back button.
No, they don't like the back button.
But you know what? Like, what if... But it's helped evolve.
No,
you know?
I agree.
It's
I agree. I think that it
platform,
is a useful,
right?
Feature. Yeah, absolutely. I think that the competition is great, and I think Apple has been doing just fine, and I just don't think that they're losing market to people who are being duped into thinking they're buying an Apple product when they're not. Like, a lot of people, like, you know, you and I own a number of different Apple products among us and between us, and you know, it's good, like good, you know, stuff in pretty much every case of, like, every device we have now seems to be pretty solid, and it's like, you know, I'm saying this from a position of liking their products, and also from a position of knowing that companies sue each other constantly. Microsoft is devious in their constant, often empty threats on Linux and other, you know, other platforms where they're claiming to own patents and intellectual property on things that they frankly don't own and won't elaborate on, and try to use vague threats. And that's the outro song. Well, the show notes are at djmcloud.com. And, you know, this is podcast number 47. You know, on October 8th, I'm pretty sure is the date, at the Wohl State Center in Cleveland, Jessica, you and I are going to see Neil Young.
That's right. And Crazy Horse.
Neil Young, and he has his old school backing band Crazy Horse with him. It's really cool. I saw Neil Young in 1997 or maybe 1998, the year he was touring with Horde Fest, and that's why I went to Horde Fest. It wasn't the kind of thing I might go to every year, but that year it had Beck and Neil Young. And you gotta remember, this is like, I think 97 back, you know, I mean, I'm pretty sure, you know, he opened with Devil's Haircut. Like, this was before he released that terrible album. Oh, you know what? Mutations in 98 wasn't bad. I mean, I listened to it a good deal. I can't say it's one of the great albums out there, but it's a good album. And some of his really early stuff is really good. And Mel Gold is good. But and Odelay is excellent.
Yeah,
but
think about all the great songs that he's brought.
You know, Midnight Vultures is such a terrible piece of shit. It's just, it ruined any interest on my part of any further music in this part. And I don't think he's made a good song since, but I'm saying, like, you know, I got stuck listening
to
that.
I hope the concert isn't all that album.
Oh, no, I'm well on a tangent. This is Beck.
Oh.
Midnight Vultures, 99. Neil Young's last, like, compelling album was probably the album that accompanied his 97 tour with Crazy Horse. The
That shows how much I know about Beck, by the way.
No, I had kind of tripped over quickly and crossed wires. So I think that Neil Young, I mean, a lot of people like his old stuff, Buffalo Springfield, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I don't know, I don't really care about that stuff that much. There's certainly a couple good songs in there and all, but it's not really my thing. I like Neil Young. Live Rust, to me, is my favorite thing. Like, you know, Harvest is, I think it's Harvest is like, I think is considered a seminal acoustic work, and it's certainly something, like, it's largely acoustic, I think, and I've listened to it, and I like it, but Live Rust, I guess Rust Never Sleeps, the studio album, but I think Live Rust is compelling, one of the great live albums I've recorded.
I'm gonna make a playlist on Spotify and get excited.
What do you think about live albums?
Live albums? I really like them.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for live albums.
Here's the one thing that I find just annoying, but
yeah.
I get it. But if you're listening to a whole series of songs and they're all live, the whole album is live, and they're from different shows, I should say. Well, no, maybe they're from the same show. At the beginning of every song, what do you hear? You hear all the crowd screaming. You know, like, again, depending on who you're listening to, but, like,
no,
Nirvana Unplugged, one of the best albums. Like,
oh,
you feel
good.
Like you are there.
You know what? Alice in Chains Unplugged is also,
yes,
excellent.
Yes. Good.
And
albums.
In fact, I think Alice in Chains Unplugged is, I don't know. I guess Nirvana Unplugged was, I have a strained relationship with that record.
I do too, especially because I feel like the beginning of the downward spiral. He was so sad. He was so dark.
Yeah, it was very much emo Kurt at that
yes.
point. But you
and
know, and
like
then he had that ragged sweater. I was always when I was young, you know, when I was like in high school, was like, while he was still alive, and then, you know, like, he died, you know what I mean? That was, like, 93, right? And he died pretty quickly after that, like, when I was, like, a freshman in high school. But I remember thinking, like, when that thing was there, it made me, you know, like, oh, that is such a cool sweater. Like, I wish I could find a sweater like that. And now I'm sure I can find a sweater like that somewhere, but I would not want it. I would not want to wear such a thing.
I remember listening to that album and hearing, Where do bad folks go when they die? They don't go to heaven when angels fly. And I loved that song.
Yeah.
It was just, I'd never heard it before, and it wasn't, I want to say Mother Love Bone, or no?
It might have been a traditional, it might have been someone else's song. You know what? I gotta tell you, he went a lot of different places. You know, he had that David Bowie cover, "The Man Who Sold the World."
Yeah.
I think, but to me, that's probably the good song on the album. Now they played some of the classics, but none of them are necessary. Like, you know what? I actually listened to the box set that I have. That's to me. That's like really the thing with Nirvana. The studio albums, I mean, what really matters with Nirvana? There's Insecticide. It's good. It's very good. Bleach, you know, I mean, I've listened to Bleach probably not as many times as I should, but I haven't really gotten that into it. Yeah,
that's Bleach to me.
It's attitude. It's, yeah.
Really fast, hard, short chord, really fast. I'm in stuff. I can play this guitar. Whereas, like, what was the song you were just talking about?
What, Man Who Sold the World?
Yeah.
That was Bowie writing, right? It has, but he had grown into that. Well, he had grown into more. That's the thing, is this is 93 Kurt Cobain, so he'd grown into his songwriting. This is only 89 to 93, you're spanning. And of course, there he's playing David Bowie's music, but yes, some of the songs on In Utero are very complex.
I mean, it was played beautifully.
It was played beautifully, I agree. And also, he had gotten more melodically complex with In Utero, but here's the thing.
And he
got
into his Bowie phase, like everybody does.
A lot of musicians have that. You also have the Meat Puppets come on the stage room because you like them. But I think 91, you have Nevermind, right? Maybe the definitive album, but I think, what do you think, like, In Utero and Nevermind have a divergence because of the hands of the producers.
Very much so.
On the one side, we have hardcore Chicago producer Steve Albini for In Utero, and on the other hand, we have noted Wisconsin producer and a member of Garbage, Butch Vig. Producing, and so I mean, it's not like Nirvana's. Nevermind is a garbage album, and whatever. I mean, I think in fact Butch Vig produced it, and then Andy Wallace, who worked with Slayer, mixed it. But still, what happened with the, like? Then you hear the live version, so. Yeah, I think it's incredible the difference that you get with the live version of a song like Smells Like Teen Spirit or whatever. So I like From the Muddy Banks of the Wishka, the 97 live album, and I like that the ragtag mix of like takes and versions on that CD box set that I have. With the Lights Out, I think it's called, but you know, it's like that stuff has an undiluted Nirvana where you're not going through the heavy prism of 90s rock production and with very different hands. I mean, you could even say In Utero, I mean, is it raw? Is it heavy? Yeah, but it has a very dynamic feel. I want to know who mixed it. It would be interesting. But, you know, what do you think is the most important album out of all those?
I think it's Nevermind.
Well, that's a perfectly legitimate argument. I do think it was the one that really defined things.
And I want to say, like, it brought about to more people, you know, this different kind of music, this shift away from hair metal, 80s rock, and a little bit into this just different sound.
Yeah, even if Nirvana, in a lot of ways, didn't realize that's what they were doing.
No.
Which is very possible.
Right.
And it's not clear exactly how self-aware Kurt Cobain was about his transformative effects. It's not clear how, say, maybe probably people like Butch Vig, probably a little more savvy about that. I mean, but, you know, it's just not clear.
And, like, his voice was so real. It wasn't all like, you know, it was, dreamy and, like, you know, like this garage band kind of, like, guttural feel. It was good. I liked it. That was one of the first CDs I ever bought. I still remember. Like, takes me back to a moment.
Now, if you think about the timing, the tempo, the pace of what that kind of, you know, comes out with, let's consider the one from the Muddy Banks of the Wishka Live album that was released posthumously with respect to Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, it's got a different sound. He plays it differently, right?
Yeah, the live sound has to me is much more compelling, but it's you know, it's different.
He's having
what? Flash blocker issues?
Well, I was going to say he's having Google Play as his choice tonight.
Well, I have to find... Yeah, I have to try... I don't know why this won't let me... The thing isn't letting me turn it off.
Oh my gosh, this sounds like that podcast we were listening to.
No, nothing is as bad as Sarah Tea Time. Sarah Tea Time is the worst fucking podcast ever. That is such a piece of shit. Do you remember, like, what she was like? I'm at my mom's house in Michigan, and I'm using a really old computer, and I don't know why it's slowing down. Like, are you fucking kidding me? That was terrible.
She went on really a long time, and, you know, there's a thing called edit. So
and there's also a thing called content. Like, there's the way of having no fucking sense at all about compelling storyline or content or anything. Like you have to give people a fucking angle. You've got to give them something like the lightning there, the thunder. I mean, yeah, they can't see the lightning, but they could hear the thunder and the rain earlier. At least the rain, right? Like, well, we're in Ohio, so we're giving you some of the local character by recording in this back room that's, like, kind of bolted onto the house in the sense that the walls are easily the thinnest. It's the most exposed room right out into the backyard. So the sound, the weather, it kind of comes through a lot quicker here. And, you know, so now, I mean, okay, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to Ohio. I don't know if you know, maybe you make one of those kinds of jokes that people make about Ohio. Now, you go ahead and fucking make them for all we care. Jessica grew up in California, and I grew up in Illinois, and we've lived other places. It's not like, you know, whatever. It's not a big deal. But anyway, you know, or maybe you really like Ohio because you met some nice people from there. I don't know. But, like, whatever. You know, it's a tempestuous place weather-wise. It's going to be freezing pretty soon, probably, because it gets really cold. But, it was hot in the summer, and, you know, I don't know. Like, I mean, there's some sort of detail there. I mean, Ohio, I'm talking in generalities about Ohio, but just recently I was talking about a specific room in a backyard. Like, I don't know. If you just fucking talk about how, like... You know, I totally lived in L.A. for a little while because I signed a 6-month rental contract. And then, like, maybe talk about your fucking landlord at your stupid short stay in L.A. or something. You're really just making excuses for being in Chicago. She's in Chicago. Like, I mean, I don't know. I should challenge her to, like, a rap battle or something.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Fine, I should just say your podcast is fucking terrible.
Yeah.
But, so, I was giving you, like, a tour of podcasts. You know what? I was listening... Oh, well, okay. You know, there's some shit that I listen to that it's amazingly, like, terrifyingly bad, sometimes in a fascinating way. That's our tea time stuff. I don't have any time for it. That's not even compelling or, you know, in its shittiness or anything. It just had someone that I follow on Twitter... went on it, you know, a while ago, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to listen. I'm like, oh, this host is just a nightmare. She just smothers every interesting story and just talks about herself and talks in, like, dopey, you know, nobody comedian cliche crap, you know, like fucking Twitter, you know? But, okay, so I gave you a tour of all sorts of crap podcasts. I'm just kind of taking a peek at Downcast to try to get a sense of what kind of junk. Oh, you heard a little bit of the talk show with John Gruber.
Okay, refresh my memory.
Oh, there's a guy talking to O'Malley.
Oh, yeah. I still like BlackBerry.
Who said that?
O'Malley, didn't
he? Oh, he probably did. Yeah.
I was the first journalist for BlackBerry, and they still have a phone.
I can't believe how,
like,
droll, boring, corporate, and sycophantic O'Malley comes off as. It's really just like borderline bad energy.
Well, and that guy was like, oh, you have at OM as your Twitter? Do you get like a bunch of weird shit? Like, what?
Oh,
oh
yeah.
My God. While
he does sometimes dwell on trivialities, I love your impression of John Gruber. That's like, you know, that's the guy with the daringfireball.net blog, and he's very well known in the Apple community. And he lives in Philadelphia. He's kind of like an Apple world celebrity because one time Steve Jobs mentioned him.
Are you insinuating that my interpretation was not flattering? And therefore,
no,
I'm like offending this guy.
No, it was totally awesome. I bet.
Oh.
No, he seems like he's probably a pretty cool guy. I bet he would
that's
think
what he sounds like
that
to
was
me.
Funny. No, he actually does actually sound as much like that as you could probably sound.
It's like
and
very radio voicey, but kind of like.
Is it? I think he's actually acquired a little bit of polish. Yeah. That's just kind of the way that he is on it on the radio, and he's actually, yeah, no, it's a certain kind of attitude and whatever, and but I think he's actually like if anything, if you heard that, he'd probably think it was funny. I don't know. He seems like he's a pretty cool guy, but you got to understand, he's like. He's very close to Apple. I mean, you know, it's like they give him inside access. Again, Steve Jobs mentioned him once. So he was already a really big Apple blogger. And now he's kind of like, I mean, I don't know how you could be any bigger as an Apple blogger. Be like one of the most popular Apple bloggers. And then also Steve Jobs mentioned you once. And you are going to get an iPhone 5.
That would make you like you scream like a little girl.
Well, yeah, it might have been a setup. It might have been like a nest, you know, like one of those minor issues, like over antennas or something. And I think Gruber was kind of backing up what Apple thought, or just speaking in a way that it was just in accord with them. I don't think he was fed the line at all, but he said something that worked so like Steve Jobs, maybe just to get an interview over quickly or something, said like, yeah, what Gruber said is right. Like, you know, like, and it's just funny because, yes, you would figure that guy would follow the 10 biggest Apple blogs and pay rabid attention to them, but you just couldn't be sure, could you? No one would be sure that they're like, oh, yeah, no, he definitely goes to Daring Fireball and, you know, iMore, I guess, whatever, like, whatever Apple blog. No, he might just not care. And he's definitely bigger than just some blog. But then all of a sudden he's like, yeah, what that guy said. So is he being fed that by his people? Or is he like, you know, flipping to that site on an iPhone or something or whatever? And it's like, so when those high corporate powers come down to the blogger level and mention them, like, it's a defining event that isn't appreciated as much now because there's the day-to-day yakking about BlackBerry and stuff. Okay, so how about another podcast I played for you? Mark Maron.
Refresh my memory.
He's the guy that whines about what he ate and his cats. All right. Well,
that sounds like a lot of podcasts. Sorry. Be more specific.
It's pretty popular. When we saw that dude Ramon, I mean, in the comedy world.
He's the comedian.
But fairly obscure.
Is he the one that was like, I wasn't famous, but now I'm famous?
Oh, that was... Right, he's often... Like, he's... Yeah, that was a pretty bad opening. Like, actually... Like,
that's
it was,
him?
That was... Yes,
yeah.
But now that I think about it, I remember that when you're talking about, like... I like showbiz. Is that okay? Like,
he sounds
was,
like a weenie to me.
It was not a good moment. Like, and actually, recently he had a very not good moment.
Another one.
There's, you know, those two guys on the Sarah Silverman show. Like she had a Real World sister. They played gay guys.
Yes.
Yeah. They did comedy tours and stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, one of them, and I'm not sure which.
They
kind of
look like.
I mean, they're both big dudes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like the one of them. I think I know which, but I'm not even completely sure.
It does probably doesn't matter.
It does not matter.
Okay.
And one of them recently did an interview with Marc Maron, and the whole opening, you know, it's his podcast, so he's going to control it.
One's funnier than the other, though.
Probably.
Yeah.
At the beginning of one podcast, he's talking about, well, I heard that this guy finally got off weed. He got off marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Marc Maron's a former cokehead.
Okay.
And it's just, it's so absurd. You know what I mean? Like, he's looking at, like, some guy who used to smoke weed, decided not to. Literally, on the interview, he says, it will turn out to be, like, one of the easiest things I ever did. Oh, really? Oh, it's easy? You mean, like, you just say I want to stop, and then you stop? Like, okay. Like, because Marc Maron's taking it from, like, the cokehead angle. He's the guy who used to he was the young guy hanging out with Sam Kinison doing coke. And now, you know, I guess he claims to be sober. Who cares?
Has he never done
people, anything? So many people lie about being sober. It's almost impossible to believe anyone. And anyway, who cares if you're sober or not? But anyway, sorry?
Yeah, they have to state it, that their agent probably makes them state it.
Well, he's talking about, he's saying like, oh, well, he recently got off weed and then, you know, he's doing really well. It's like, oh, well, I don't know. He was on TV before. He was touring comedy. Maybe this is helping him focus and that's like totally cool. But instead of looking at it from like a specific self-improvement mechanism, he looks at it as like this triumph over addiction, which is like, no, you're a fucking triumph over addiction if you're not snorting coke because you were a cokehead. But don't just lump in people doing something, you know, like having a couple beers or smoking a couple, you know, bong hits and like making it equivalent with your, you know, coke habit, which you can, you know, whatever. You can indulge if you want. You probably have the money to do it now with the podcast advertising and selling all that bullshit, you know, like you know, which reminds me, we have to get to that segment. We said we would do that read. So I guess, you know, I don't know. I think you know, I gotta do some advertising on the show.
Alright.
So let me do that read. It's not in an Evernote, it's in a Dropbox.
But it is politics season,
well,
and it's a great time to get ads, and we're gonna take any ad we can get, even from a place like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's all these shadowy groups in politics. Can you believe the influence of corrupt shadowy groups? You don't know what these groups are called. You don't know what they're doing.
But if they have
it's
America, freedom, liberty, an eagle and a bell and an American flag and stars on their logo.
Citizens United.
Yeah. Americans for a better tomorrow.
yeah, that's also true. But like the Citizens United case was, I mean, oh, it's all bad news. And it's like, when are people going to wake up? You know? When are they going to turn around, wake up, get to the center, and find, you know, find the middle ground.
Well, didn't we just talk about...
Don't people need to reach out?
Didn't we talk about a new sense of awakening coming?
Oh, yeah, like for real, yeah, but not through politics, yeah. 2012?
Yep.
2012 is the year of the Google Reader app. I you know, people don't appreciate RSS feeds. Who uses RSS anymore? Who uses RSS readers?
No, you just follow them on Twitter or Facebook.
It's just such a crude technology. It's proprietary.
RSS?
And so crude. No,
Twitter,
the
and,
Twitter
Facebook.
And Facebook compared
yeah.
to RSS. Like,
I agree.
I think, for sure. It's just like, I mean, if you want to follow 400 news sources, even if most of their news just goes by in the stream, like, does Twitter really work for that, you know?
100?
400.
400?
Well, let me see how many I have on Google Reader right now.
Why do you follow 400?
Well, you know, I find a blog here and a newspaper there and, you know, a couple extra, you know, feeds of aggregators and you know, pretty soon, you know, I have some podcast feeds there and pretty soon you have a lot. Let me look at the trends tab. 813 subscriptions. So it's a little more than 400. It's moving.
So if you have over, I would say 50, then yes, RSS feed.
I just, it's, you know, like, here's another problem. Like, Google, the new Twitter apps, it's hard to click on stuff. You have to click on the whole tweet, so Twitter can try to load the tweet locally into the app, and then you can click on a link from there.
It's really annoying to click on shit in Twitter.
Twitter is making the experience very difficult.
It's
and they're
horrible.
Trying to reroute
I'm
the way they do. They're
horrible,
trying to make
horrible,
you
horrible.
Only use services that project into Twitter. That you know, come up in those whatever they're calling them, panels or windows or, you know, tabs or something like. But they have those little panels that pop up of like if somebody has an Instagram, it'll come up as an inline image inside the Twitter app. You can then click on the Instagram URL above, but the picture is down there already. So most people are just going to just see the picture there, right? And stay in the Twitter app. So it's all about keeping people inside the app. And I'm pretty sure that Android and iOS versions are both doing that. And it's just, you know, it's nuts. So anyway, if you want to start taking back, like, yeah, I mean,
well,
I would say keep
Facebook
using Twitter, but you make a backup. Like Google Reader allows you to export OPML. So you can get the files out of it, and then you can use a different reader. So start with Google Reader if you want. It's simple, but, you know, whatever you want to use. But if you have Google Reader, there's a lot of these client apps that are built to read right off Google Reader. So if I have these 800 subscriptions, I can read, you know, the latest or whatever, like, or them sorted through categories. And, you know, you can go to the website, but there's also ways to get, you know, Google Reader. I have Google Reader for Android. Because it's Android, you can, you know, it's a first-party app. Google has a Google Reader. It's very simplistic. It's really almost just like using, like, a simplified web page, you know. But it works. You know, you can get to stuff, and you can add stuff to Pocket like I do, or, like, you know, or just go to a browser, you know, or look at, you know, articles. If the feed has content in it, it'll display it. You know, it's pretty good. But there's actually some pretty good ones for the iOS platform. And there's the Reader app for iPhone, which I use, and I think that's a pretty good app. You know, that's the good way to get that stuff on your iPhone. Now, I installed the Reader app on your iPad. I don't know. Have you? You know, like we have a, but it just. I don't think you're not like a frequent user of the feeds. But I was wondering what you thought of the design of it, in terms of like the way that the layout compares to the desktop app and the iPhone app. Like that's, you know, I don't know. It kind of starts like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you think of that, app?
Boring.
Yeah, the iPad one is a little sparse. It's a little off. I like the iPhone one because there's the right amount of information density. I think that thing has, like, these expanses that just don't work. And it has, like, I don't know. It doesn't have the right feel. But I think it has a good iPhone app. And the desktop app, you can get one. You know, you can get the iPhone app. But there's also a Mac app store, like, you know, Mac desktop app. And that one is pretty good. Although it takes a long time to load and it crashes, it still is more reliable than its competitor, Caffeinated. And that was another thing. Like, I talked about Caffeinated in a previous episode. And I thought, you know, it's interesting and it's a change from Reader. This one is spelled with two E's. But, like, you know, it's a change. But the problem is it just always crashes. And Google Reader, like, seems to be, like, a slow service. Like, Google doesn't really worry about it too much. And so it just takes, like, an extra, you know, instant to load on stuff. So I don't really blame the apps for being a little sluggish, which Reader is, all three versions. But it seems like the iPad's the fastest, but it's also, like, the most boring. I don't know. But this Caffeinated thing, it just crashes constantly. Like, you know, I mean, because I talked about it on a previous podcast, I thought it was pretty cool, but I don't know. At this point, I would recommend against getting it now, although it's only a few bucks and it's not a big deal. Maybe it'd be cool to support the developer and hope they, you know, keep trying to fix it, because they do come out new versions, but the thing just crashes. The thing is, all right, some of these things are going to crash in a startup, maybe trying to connect to Google services or whatever, but Caffeinated will only run, it must have some ridiculous memory hole, because it'll only run for a couple hours before it, like, basically locks up your whole computer. You know, and I use it on this MacBook Pro. This is a pretty powerful machine. Just, you know, it just sucks all the resources away. So, what did you think of The Dark Knight?
I thought it was a fun, action-packed movie. I didn't like it as much as the one before.
Yeah, I think a lot of people like Dark Knight better than Dark Knight Rises, but I'm in the minority, I guess. I think that it's the best one in the series. You know, I don't really like Batman Begins, although I guess it is sort of trying to showcase what he would do with subsequent movies, but still, I just don't like that as a movie. But I do like The Dark Knight, but I thought that Dark Knight Rises was very well played. I mean, it's almost hard to believe it was 2 hours, 45 minutes. I thought there was a pretty compelling pace throughout. And, of course, there are things about it that are not logical. There can't be any logic behind the idea of somebody basically beating Batman and then just sending him to a prison, except some weird idea about making him relive his childhood traumas. Like, why? I don't know. Why go all the way wherever that is? But, you know, moving the plot along, and it is a Batman movie. And then, you know, at the end, I guess it was so weird the way that Bane was all subservient to Talia al Ghul, or whatever her name is, and that just, wasn't that strange, where Bane was such a, like, powerful figure for the whole thing, and then at the end, like, he's caught up with, like, just emotional dependence on this other person, that it's just, I don't know, you know what I mean, not even a love story angle, more of just a kind of, like, a sad, dependent loyalty kind of thing that's maybe rooted in some sort of love, but it doesn't seem like compelling enough. It just seems like, and I guess that maybe there's a foreshadowing when he's at that court hearing and they said Bane has no authority here. You assume that that's just like kind of a pat response, like, because it's like, well, it's so obvious that he is so powerful, and if you just said everybody in this room started doing flash dance, everybody would start singing Maniac or whatever, like, you know, it's like, but maybe, you know, he really was much more limited, but he, you know, anyway, I don't know. And it sounded strange to me. I guess he's sort of a 90s comic book figure, and I wasn't really familiar with, you know, Bane. And I never saw Batman and Robin because I guess he was in that, but I was just sort of done with that franchise by then for sure.
Yeah.
So I thought they really made him into a compelling character where I was like, oh, this is a total comic book character. And they move that type of character into what is, I think, frequently thought of as a series that's very much a trying to be a real world series with a comic book kind of edge to it or something. Like, you know, everything they don't go into the kind of granular detail of, like, it's not Sim City, but I mean, you know, like, they talk about, like, the mayor and the police force and the citizenry and all, like, you know, it's not in some complete parallel universe, like, you know, I mean, it is, but, you know, I don't know, I thought it was the best one in the series, and, you know, I don't see movies that often, but, I thought that one was good. And then, yeah, we recently saw Snow White and the Huntsman.
It was alright. I like the concept of the story, you know, telling a different angle of a fairy tale. It was neat. It was a neat interpretation of Snow White. It's the Grimm's fairy tale. I read that. You know, I had that growing up.
Really? Mm-hmm. Were you familiar? Now, I had no idea. Everything that was different from the Disney cartoon version was a total surprise to me. Because when I was little, you know, we had a tape of that somebody taped off a TV, like VHS or something. And, you know, I saw it a few times. Not too many, but... you know, enough to kind of know the basics of that story. And it is different. I mean, you know, I don't know. I was surprised at how I thought it was fairly well done. And I didn't really expect it to be worth a shit. And it was all right.
I didn't like Snow White as much. I like her. I think she's interesting, but I think I just kept seeing her as the Twilight girl.
Her
voice is weird.
Really? I think she's just fine. I don't know. I never got at all... I never paid any attention to Twilight. So I don't... I guess I came with, like, very much less preconceived notions about it. And it is difficult. Anybody who's in... a movie that had that kind of ticket sales is going to be somewhat typecast in that role for at least a little while. I had a clip that I was going to play after this this break. There's a clip that comes from Fox News. This is some idiot. She's trying to make a case for George W. Bush, and because that's literally impossible, she starts stammering. And you start wondering if she got hit with that confusion gun, you know, that shoots the waves that confuse people's brains that they use on news anchors.
Is that the case, Angela, or is the president sidestepping the issue because the economy is still on the minds of voters? He's been campaigning. Mitt Romney is campaigning. Is it important enough that the issue of economy and voters should take a backseat and that we should still be talking about foreign policy?
Foreign policy is very important. National security is very important. Jamin, if we don't protect our homeland, we're not going to have an economy. And Julie, he might have come out and said that this was a terrorist attack the day of, but Jay Carney, our U.S. ambassador, and Secretary Clinton all said that these were spontaneous attacks. And now we know, we have information that was classified that's now been released that this was a planned terror attack. And the problem is, we don't know what our national security plan is. When we had President Bush, we knew where we stood. We knew we were protected. We knew we had power through strength, strength through power, or peace through strength, strength through peace through power. The bottom line is this, with this administration, we don't have that.
I got to leave it there, but certainly Ronald Reagan wasted no time to come out and talk about issues.
She's laughing.
Yeah, I mean, what is she saying? It's this, like, I mean, you know, it's this mishmash of stuff, and you wonder, like, you know, some people are given these very simple set of instructions about what to say, right?
Yes.
And when you see, you know, this McGlaughlin here, Angela McGlaughlin, I mean, you know, what a clown, right? Like, these people, they're such stooges, and they're just fed these lines. A lot of times, they cannot handle their lines. Like, they're not very good. And it's like, it's amazing how much of this stuff is just shaped by PR. And like, I mean, there's actually plenty of like, you know, journalists and podcasters and bloggers that delve into these issues a lot. It's just, but it's so crazy how, you know, in the age of the internet, the information, like, you know, these public relations companies, it's so much harder to plant. I mean, it's easier for them to plant bullshit, yes, but it's also much harder for them, that stuff, to take root for long. There's so many debunkers out there, and there's all sorts of nuts, right? But there's a big gray area of people that are into, like, you know, they just believe in something, or they want to disprove something, or they're skeptical about something, and, like, you know, there's a lot of people that are going to inform, you know, someone that blogs or podcasts about something, and it's going to get out. If you know, there's people combing over stuff, not everything's getting looked at, but these days, you know, there's a lot more of that kind of, you know, low-level activism that leads to people kind of being like, I mean, I don't know, though. I mean, and there's still just that mass media, right? And, like, those people, I mean, they're programming a certain percentage of the population, right? And you know, it's really just a question, like, you know, what percent, right? That's what everything's divided into. Even Mitt Romney with his 47%.
He wishes.
You know, I mean, that's exactly it. Like, he managed to include groups that include, whatever, retired veterans and, you know, people's grandmothers, people, you know, people that are on, you know, Medicare, stuff like that.
47% of our nation is crazy, then.
Well, he's saying 47%. No, you know, his 47% that he said in this stupid, like, comments that he made were that 47% of people are dependent on government. And they'll always vote for Obama. Even though, you know, Obama is not the kind of, you know, government entitlement type of creator that he's portrayed as. It's just typical Republican fiction bullshit, you know. But even if that were true, look, we need a better safety net in this country for people that, you know, that need help, you know, instead of that culture of, like, helping people out until they can, you know, get going again and get in the right direction. Like you talk about in Australia and other places, that's kind of more the culture there, I think. And, you know, according to what you've told me, whatever, you know, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that's kind of where, you know, I mean, that's where we need to go. But anyway, Obama's not doing enough in that direction is the real issue. But, you know, the Republicans make these false arguments. Well, Romney's including in this 47% people that are, like, retired veterans. Or people that are on, you know, benefits, you know, temporary benefits, you know, Medicare, you know, whatever. People that are just, you know, normal people receiving, like, what's pretty much considered normal, you know, benefits. You know what I mean? People's grandparents. You know what I mean? Like, he's not 47% dependent on government, really. Like, there's those people that have, like, paid into the system their whole lives. And then they're just receiving their Social Security check like they've paid into the system for.
Yeah, basically, he's just like, I just have to worry about this 10% to get myself elected, and then I can do whatever the hell I want.
Well, that's it, and he's...
Hello, people.
I mean, it's so obvious, and there's
a message for everyone.
I was showing you some of those polls, right? It looks like Barack Obama is making a move even further up, and it isn't, you know what I mean? We're talking about, like, the differences between other years, and, like, 2000, you know, Al Gore came out with a strong convention, you know, bounce, but everyone knew that he was going to peel away because he just had all these problems, like with interacting, with giving, you know, speeches, with having, you know, with having the right kind of tone, you know. And Obama, Barack Obama is very cool, and he's not, you know, he's not really doing enough.
like, I don't know if he's really gonna turn out the, you know, the rhetorical cannons here. Him and Bill Clinton barnstorming the country, giving big speeches, or if he's just gonna kind of duck and cover this, and, you know, just kind of, I don't know if that's the right word. That's, but do you know what I mean? Like, he's gonna kind of just, like, you know, run on third and long and figure that he's got the defense to win or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, he's just, and that's fine, I guess. Like, I'm not in charge, and I don't have a really strong feeling about it. I just think that the more I know about Romney, the more I hear about him, the more I learn, like, it's worse. It's worse than you would even think of some stooge guy that's just basically a religious fanatic and a big business shill who's moved jobs to China, evaded, you know, tax, done what any normal person would consider evading and paying practically nothing as a percentage in taxes. I mean, yeah, I mean, maybe he has paid some percentage of his income, but it's a low percentage, much lower than your normal taxpayer pays, and yet he makes much more. He has total arrogance of power. He talks down. He says openly, like you said, he actually says, even the phraseology he uses is very open about, I don't have to worry about those people. Like, that's exactly how, you know, and Obama is so easy to just say, like, well, I want to be president for all Americans, like, you know, like all that, but, I mean, you know, it's just, yeah, these people are openly running is pretty much the way they are. And why is that? And I was wondering, are they losing the political pros even? Are people losing confidence? Do they not get the hotshot, you know, young political advisors, the energetic, you know, staffers in their 20s and 30s that are going to run around and bust their ass for the guy instead of the guys just collecting the paycheck as the staffers, the country club Republicans that know that he's a rich guy and just want to hang around him? Or is he just too attracting too extreme an element because he's too extreme?
We're just going to have to find out when you do your investigative report and go undercover as a volunteer. You can tell us what it's like.
Okay, so I have to explain that comment. I told Jessica that I was thinking about infiltrating the Romney campaign in terms of going to one of their local offices. I'm not saying I'm going to go to Washington and be carrying his briefcase around, you know, shredding his briefings and whatever. No, I'm saying that, like, I was talking about going to a local campaign office and then, you know, maybe just hanging out and getting some, you know, leaking the stuff that they were talking about. You know, I'd be like, I could just come in and say, you know, hey, I'm an MBA, you know, I just don't understand what this country is anymore, like, whatever that bullshit those idiots say, you know, like, I think I could try to imitate it, you know, the tone, I'd have to get rid of the laughter, I'd have to get the right tone, but, you know, I'd come up with the words, you know, I'd come up with, you know, some kind of nonsense that's, you know, that's convincing enough, I think, but here's the thing, it would be more fun, but less kind of devious, instead of, you know, hanging around the place and hearing everything and over and leaking and, you know, I'd like to get, like, a bunch of campaign flyers, you know, and then go, say I'll go to this neighborhood and go to, like, a really urban district, you know, which they'd all be, like, probably afraid to go or wouldn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just go in and I would just talk to people and be like, all right, you know, I don't know who, you know, I think you should probably vote. I was going to, you know, I came in here and I just got the sense you're probably going to vote for the president, right? Okay, I think you're making the right decision. And then just, you know, I don't know, like, but that's not enough sabotage. Maybe I'd want to go to more Republican neighborhoods and go in and be like, hey, you know, like the Blues Brothers, when the Blues Brothers go into the restaurant, you know, but can I get Joey to be like the Elwood to my Jake, you know, like something
sure.
Like that.
That would work.
All right, well, we're coming up on an hour here. So thanks for listening to this episode of the DJMCloud.com podcast. And Jessica, thank you for making your appearance on this episode, the first one in a number of weeks.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. Now, I have the dinosaur sound up here. Did we go over the dinosaur sound already? I think we may have already audioed it out. So, I think we have to make our own dinosaur sound.
Yeah, it's way back there.
Yeah, so we have to do our own exit sound, you know. Cool? Okay.
you know, the other thing that you could do is if you know, if you want to support the podcast, go to screenbird.djmcloud.com. And there is a link to buy MP3s on the Google Play Store. You can also torrent them for free, which is fine. But if you want to, you know, implicitly support the show, you could buy some of the Screenbird music. Now, it's a strange formula. We give away the better music, though. But the Screenbird music is sort of the B-sides, and I just kind of as an experiment sell it. But I also let people torrent it, so you don't have to pay for it. But the neater stuff is the stuff I do with Jessica. And whereas Screenbird is like these half-baked songs that don't fully bake into neater songs. So, you know, that's kind of how that works. And I think that, you know, so if you can also get the neater music by going to blogs.sf3am.com/neater.
Yeah.